Hi, my name is Sarah Tulloch, Talking Writing's podcast production manager, and this is the Talking Writing podcast. Please enjoy the episode.
Welcome, Naomi Cohn, and thank you for joining me for the Talking Writing podcast. Naomi Cohn is the author of The Braille Encyclopedia, Brief Essays on Altered Sight, and it is described as a revelatory memoir on her progressive vision loss and embrace of Braille as part of relearning to read and write as an adult. And it's told in the form of imagined alphabetical encyclopedia entries, which I really liked. So when the hosts decided who wanted to take this book, I was like, I want to take this book, please. It's me. So I'm glad that you were able to join us today, Naomi. It's interesting as well, not just because of the form of an imagined encyclopedia entry, but also like because it shapeshifts between different genres, right? It's considered a hybrid genre between lyric essay, prose poetry. And in fact, this was supposed to be a collection of prose poems when you started out. Can you talk us through? I'm going to give the floor to you. Can you talk us through the process of you conceptualizing and creating this book? It was supposed to be prose, a collection of prose poems. And I only knew about that because I came across your interview at Monson Arts, right? And so you said there you needed to go through a radical rewrite to create the Braille Encyclopedia.
Yes.
So what was the decision making around that? And how did you decide for the prose poems to transform into the Braille Encyclopedia?
Okay, thank you for setting that up so beautifully for me. So it definitely was a radical rewrite. And I think the first thing I'd say is it was really more a process of discovery than a decision. And the story is even more drawn out because I had mostly been a poetry writer for many years. And I was interested in prose and was exploring prose. And I had the idea of doing a suite of essays on the tools that I use as a legally blind person. So my white cane, I still use a camera. I was just learning Braille and sort of the contradictions. And my glasses, of course, I don't even think of them. They're the water I swim in. So I thought, I'm just going to write a little, 3,000 word essay or something. And then this thing morphed into a book, this collection of entries. And I have to credit, I read Rebecca Solnit's Cyclopedia of an Arctic Expedition, which was in her, I think it's called the Encyclopedia of Trouble and Spaciousness. And it's a collection of her essays. And I just thought, oh, this is the form. This is so great. It's just alphabetical. And but she creates this world. She gives us this sense of her trip to the Arctic. And so I thought, that's what I need to do. And it's going to be an essay. And that's so great because I don't know how to write an essay. and then it just exploded into this much bigger project. And then I kind of thought, well, I'm just not very narrative or like, so maybe these are prose poems, but they're sort of linked and they kind of together collect into some kind of sense of a story or an experience. So that was actually how Rose Metal Press, who's publishing the book, accepted it. They said, okay, it's this collection of links to prose poems. And they took it in late 2020. And the timeline for publication was very stretched out because they had found the pandemic was a really difficult situation for their authors. So they rightfully wanted to wait until they could do justice to it. And they also said, and we're going to want some revisions. And so I had way too much time during the pandemic and after to think about, oh, well, I want to fill in these missing entries and I want to answer this question. So by the time they came back with actual edits, I was like, oh, you know what? I want to write prose. I don't want them to be prose poems. So it was, as I say, more of a process than a single decision.
It's amazing how the difference of time can give you that perspective and that kind of insight into the work that you would never have if you made that decision, or you know, if you went through that process in a shorter amount of time, probably.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So like in some ways, people are like, what, your book is enough? They kept asking, is it your book? Aren't you, when are you going to do that? But it actually was a real gift. And I've really changed as a writer in those years. And also just knowing what a manuscript or a particular poem or essay needs, time is the best way for me to know, you know, if I'm
which, you know, a lot of writers, they know that, but they hate hearing that because, you know, you're always anxious. As a writer, you're always anxious. When are people going to read this? When can I publish this? Or who's going to publish this, right?
Yeah.
And so 2020 to 2024. And by the way, your book launches October 23rd, isn't it?
That's October. Right. That's
yeah.
Right.
And so 4 years, aside from an exercise in patience, right? like what else did you learn about writing? That was there a time when you were like, oh, I just don't want to think about this, you know, I'm sick of this, you know, thinking about this manuscript or something?
I definitely didn't think of it at all for a while. I enjoyed the, oh my goodness, I'm going to have a book out in the world, and isn't that lovely? And I just worked on other things. And then closer to probably last year, I started being like, oh, I know I have work to do on this. And what's that going to be? But by then I was ready to reengage with it. And I think I had learned a lot, also thanks to the lovely pandemic. I'm, you know, being sarcastic, but I took a lot of online classes as a way of having community. And, you know, I have a ton of writing experience, but I thought, okay, I'm going to take more classes on essay and personal prose writing. So I learned a ton about what I like and what I don't like.
Uncanny that you also mentioned Rebecca Solnit. I forgot to put it in my notes, but your, you know, the Braille Encyclopedia, some of the, I wouldn't say style, but some of the feel of it, if you can say that, reminded me of A Field Guide to Getting Lost, her collection of essays. I mean that as a compliment. Yes, definitely.
I'm very honored. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because she has an essay there describing the color blue, like the blue of distance, and all of that. And you know, it's different. It's different things, different topics, obviously, but the rhythm, you know, it really evokes that kind of style, which I gravitate towards, right? But before we get even more distracted, I wanted to ask the follow-up question to the process of deciding the form that your book was going to take. Mm-hmm. For the writers listening to our podcast, what would be your advice in evaluating, you know, which genre a piece of idea or writing should be expressed in?
That's such a great question, and it's one I still struggle with. I tend to write a thing, and then I share it with people who I trust, you know, sort of my poetry group, and they tell me what's maybe missing for them. And so in some sense, I guess everything I write is a poem in the sense of, you know, the origin of the word poem is supposed to be from the Greek poesis, and it's a creation or a made thing. And that's kind of ultimately my attraction to words, is it's one of the ways I assemble things. And so I don't have too much of a plan. I'm not one of those. I used to be a potter you work in clay, for example. And I was never one of those people who was like, I'm going to make a dinner set and it's going to have 8 cups and 8 perfectly flat plates. It was more like, I'm going to sculpt this thing and then sort of decide, well, what do I need to do to it? Does it have a use in the world? Am I going to fire it? And I don't recommend it as a way of writing, but it is how I write. So some of the And then that sort of, to be more helpful to your listeners, I think, so there's an internal piece, like I'm trying to discern what this project or book or object wants to be. And then in revision, I actually like to put things kind of through the filter of, if I'm writing something that came out sort of as prose, maybe I actually put it through making it into a line, a poem with line breaks, and see what it's like that way. Or reverse, like when I was more of a strictly spending time on poetry, I would do, you know, poems in little couplets, and I was very interested in form, and here's a sonnet. And then I would take what I had written and just put it into a prose block. And I always learned something. And my intention then was to put it back into being a lined poem. But I always learned something about what was unnecessary or missing by doing that. So that's a really inefficient and experiential way of making that decision. But
trial and error.
Yeah. Right.
There's no like scientific process, the hypothesis, and, you know,
right.
Really no formula, right?
No. Though as I have gotten more comfortable with the kind of betweenness of where I write, I do also have more of a setting and intention. Like, oh, I have a real question to answer here. So that's going to be an essay with prose, or I really just want to kind of ground in the now and notice an image. That's going to be a poem for me.
So I like that.
Mm, so then there's also kind of an external piece, which is, and I feel strongly that writers should kind of keep their power about their voice and what matters to them and what they want to write about. So I'm always cautious about saying, let other people decide what a thing is. But I do sometimes finish a piece and then send it out to poetry markets and essay markets. And I just kind of see who reads it and who
responds
to it. Wow, that's
really, that's one way to make a decision, right?
Yeah. So again, that it might be, I don't mean to sound passive, but it's like, it's holding up a mirror to this thing. I'm so too close to this process and this thing I've made.
Yeah.
So, And I don't mean that in a gamey or disrespectful way to the literary journals.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it's an experiment.
Mm-hmm. And I know it's rare for writers to come up with a piece and not know the genre. Mm-hmm. For me, it's not usual anyway, but I have had that issue personally, mm-hmm. where I'm like, oh, is this supposed to be a memoir or a collection of essays or just an essay and all of that? And beyond the technical, there's always that leap of faith that you have to make. And I think the different ways of experimenting, as you said, you know, there's really no standards, and it makes it both good and bad.
Yeah. And I've kind of made peace with that. I just, that I'm very process oriented. I really enjoy writing as a process, even though, you know, I procrastinate and sometimes I avoid hard bits, but I'm mostly doing it for the pleasure. I'm not making, you know, I'm not going to get rich doing this for sure. Like,
yes, and I know we will discuss more about that later.
Yeah, right. I mean, if I wanted to make money as a writer, I would have continued being a fundraiser, which, you know, is a good living, but can be. But this writing is very much, I'm first pleasing myself or working through something I want to work through. And then I sit down and think about, well, who else, if anyone, might need to read this piece, and what needs to be different for it to be intelligible to an outside reader, interesting, hopefully. But I very much, the first, I don't know, 10 drafts are for me.
Yeah. Before we continue to the other questions, I wanted to give a bit more context about your book and you as an author. The Braille Encyclopedia are essays on altered sight. So can you expand on or explain to the listeners right now, who, you know, since your book isn't out yet, what altered sight means in your context. Because, you know, you describe yourself, legally you are described as a blind person,
mm-hmm.
but it's not really common awareness that blindness is really not monolithic, as with so many other things.
As with so many other things, exactly. Thank you for that introduction. Yeah, so just the thumbnail of my kind of physical biography of sight is that I was born sighted, lived sighted until I was about 30. And, you know, by the age of 4, I had a pair of glasses, but that wasn't considered not being fully sighted in our culture that I grew up in. And then when I was about 30, I started having a retinal condition, which damaged my central vision very slowly and progressively over in terms of my ability to function as a sighted person. So gradually over the next, I'm in my early 60s now, so gradually over the 30 years that have since passed, my sight has changed dramatically so that I no longer can read print in a normal way. I can't drive. I don't really recognize faces, but I was born visually oriented. My brain is still wired toward vision. So my vision is distorted and different, but still a very present part of my life.
Which is, thank you for explaining that, because I was going to say one of the most compelling things for me about your book is you describe this progression of your blindness, but also you have a perspective that those who are born blind do not. And so you try to bridge this sort of worlds, if you will, of the sighted and the ones with altered sight or blindness. Mm-hmm. You try to describe like what learning to read in Braille is like, the experience of it. You even said that, you know, one of the lines that I like from your book was like, old love wipes out young, when you refer to learning to read in Braille.
Mm-hmm.
And the fascination that it uses the visual cortex, that reading in Braille actually uses the visual cortex. And it actually is a sort of replacement for the love you once had for sighted reading painted signs, books, labels, etc. So I feel like it's the equivalent. It's although this is a poor comparison of like, oh, describe color to a blind person, which is not really a good statement anymore, because again, being blind is not monolithic, right?
Mm-hmm,
a lot of blind people are only partially blind, they can see color. But this, the way you explain or try to explain Braille reading and the love for Braille and learning to read again in Braille to the readers, especially for sighted readers, is really fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
And I
really appreciate how you have really picked up on the way that blindness is not monolithic. And it, like so many things that we're learning as a culture or in, is that things aren't binary, that we're all on different spectrum, or maybe it's a big rainbow of difference. And so the category of blindness that, you know, so 10 or 15% of people who are legally blind have no visual perception. I don't know if you've read Andrew Leland's recent memoir, The Country of the Blind, which is a wonderful book. And his eyesight is almost probably the opposite of mine. So he has a little, as I understand it, a little tiny central vision. So like looking through a straw, he sees a small amount clearly, but all of his periphery is gone. And I have no center, and a lot of my remaining vision is altered by the retinal damage. So I don't see anything clearly, but I have this big ambient world. And that's, you know, and then and so both in terms of different parts of our sight or losing color, there's just an infinite variety of ways of not seeing, right? So, and then also what society we live in and how society views that condition.
views and represents, right?
Like, and represents. Oh yeah.
You mentioned sort of the misrepresent. You were very gracious in you know, the misrepresentation of Braille reading in the book All the Light We Cannot See, and you know how the character was reading Braille using
Phones.
But I thought that was like a thing that is important to say, that how it matters to somebody when something is misrepresented. You know, it's not just an element, it's not just a detail, it's your life.
It is, yeah. And it was really, so the anecdote is about reading that book, and that the main character who's blind is reading with 10 fingers, and it's described that way several times, and it made me physically uncomfortable just to hear the description. And again, I don't mean to pick on Anthony Doerr. And again, as we were talking as we were getting to chat a little before the interview about imperfection, it's impossible to be perfect. I don't discount the rest of the book because of that imperfection. But yes, thank you. But it also is like, wow, that's my experience, and it doesn't even feel right. So,
it's not about the author, right? It's not really about Anthony Doerr. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. Doerr. It's not really a comment on him, more on a comment on the normalization of, okay, it doesn't matter if it's authentic or not, but it's not, for it matters to those who live the experience.
Yeah. And I do believe in I believe that writers have the right, and maybe even the responsibility, we should not limit ourselves to only things we have experienced.
Yes, definitely.
Right. Yeah. And then we also need the humility to say, oh, I got that wrong. So I know I look back at things I've written in the past and go, oh, wow, I really got that wrong.
Yeah. And as you said, no one is perfect. Which, you know, and I'm going a little bit off tangent here, like, just to ask you what you think about, because you were an editor before, you were a copy editor before, for Encyclopedia Britannica. Okay, wait, that's another discussion. But how do you feel about not really a new, but a more accepted line of editing, which is called authenticity editing or sensitivity editing, in the context of what we just talked about? Like, how do you feel about that becoming like more of a norm?
I think it's a really good thing. I guess it's also always going to be incomplete. I have a good friend who's a sensitivity editor, and they don't claim to be able to do that sensitivity audit or read on every topic. Right.
So
I think as a practical matter, I hope that writers don't feel compelled to pay for every possible like kind of thing that they're not sure they're getting right. But at the same time, I think there are ways to get that information. I think also for, like, I'll just speak from like my places of privilege as a white middle-class person, that like with a certain amount of education, I kind of nowadays I feel like I read something and I go, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. Right. So like I have some internal monitor, and that I'm okay with just leaving that out. Right. There's so much to write about in my case. And if I feel like, oh, it's really important to me to write about this piece, then I would seek out, someone else's perspective. And I'd also know, so like I'm thinking of a specific example. I wrote a piece about that was both about learning Braille and growing up on the south side of Chicago, about a mile and a half walk from where the play A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry was
conceived.
So it, the play is about redlining and racism in Chicago in the 60s, a little before I was born. And it's based on a real experience of her family moving in. She was Black and moved into an all-white neighborhood. Or they bought a house in an all-white neighborhood. They weren't really able to live there because of the vicious response to that. So I was just really interested in the geography, and that book, A Raisin in the Sun, the script, was my graduation project in learning to read Braille. So that was like how I showed that I was able to read Braille, was reading through that book.
Wow.
So it's a very resonant book to me in multiple ways. And I started to explore what I did and didn't know about race and about the geography that I grew up in. And I think it's an important piece. And I also just felt like I don't need to put this out into the world right now. So I started writing it before 2020. And I live in Minnesota, where George Floyd was murdered. And I just felt like other voices might need to come forward on that right now.
I think that's the key, is that, which is a good thing with the access to technology. As much as technology is a bad thing, because it also gives space for a lot of misinformation, but it also gives space for a lot more voices. And I brought it up because I thought the Braille Encyclopedia is a very important work as well, because it gives insight into a world that I never would have thought to look into, and having different voices and having insight into different lived experiences really kind of form that piece in a puzzle that complete us as connected beings, connected human beings.
That's lovely. Yes. That's kind of was my hope, was just to kind of invite people into my lived experience. And I don't, like, there are experiences of living with a disability in this culture that are frustrating and difficult. But that wasn't really what this book was about. It's not a book of advocacy. So it's not written with the perspective that the sighted person who might be reading it is supposed to know these things.
Exactly. It's like the responsibility is not all on our shoulders. We don't have to know all the things, right?
Which
kind of brings me to the question of knowledge, because you had a very interesting entry on knowledge in your book. You said, "What I have come to know is we don't always get to know." And that refers to, of course, many things, but for you personally, the why your blindness happened, the direct cause, like specifically, there is, sort of the cause, but it doesn't really explain why it happens to one person and not the other, right? And sometimes the more you know about these things, the less understandable it is, the less it makes sense. What kind of knowledge do you think, in your, as you lived with partial blindness, what kind of knowledge has proven most important to you? Or what kind of knowledge did you find matters most after all of the things you learned about your situation?
That's an interesting question. So I think it's probably pretty obvious from the book that I think medical knowledge hasn't been that useful to me.
I liked what, we'll have a cure in 5 to 10 years. they've said that for the last 40 years or something.
Yeah. And I don't, I do have individual doctors that I have been frustrated with, and that our medical system is a mess, but it's also a setup, right? Because we go to medicine to be fixed, right?
Yeah.
It's a relationship that's a problem, not just that the doctor is wrong, right? But we go with this expectation that bodies are fixable, curable, and we also bring a lot of, or I'll just say I brought a lot of ideas about, as I was losing my sight, I was tremendously afraid of becoming not able or blind or all of those things. So when I speak about ableism, I'm speaking from my own biases as well as from what I experience from other people, right? It's not one of those things that you are done with ever, right? It's like a ongoing process to notice, to become aware of, like, oh, that's a bias I have.
Right.
But so in terms of knowledge, sort of circling back to knowledge in general, so the medical knowledge was not that useful to me. And the sooner I got away from that, the better my life got in some ways. I think the knowledge of technology has both been really helpful and also kind of a burden, because I'm lucky that I like technology. I'm able to learn new softwares, new ways of doing things. But the trajectory is that technology changes all the time. And so there's a tremendous energy input to learn stuff. Every time I have a software update, my whole world is sort of turned upside down, right?
Exactly.
So, and there's also, as my vision evolves, different tools become appropriate. So then in a way, it's like, oh, that technical knowledge is both a blessing and a curse, right? There's always a new tool to learn, and that's exciting. But at some point, it's like, oh, I just want to get out a piece of paper and poke some Braille dots into it and be like, I can read this.
Right.
I don't have to relearn how to do that until I, injure my wrist. But like,
right. No. Yeah.
In which case I'll be, Siri, where are you?
Yeah.
I think the final knowledge is really, I'm not a practicing Buddhist, but I think that the knowledge that bodies are frail and precarious and stuff happens to us to bodies all the time, and there's no rhyme or reason or merit to it or lack of merit to it. And that's just the unfolding of being. Yeah. That's probably the most enduring knowledge, and the one that I think, to tie it back to the book, is partly why I resisted a kind of more linear, logic-based form than what the book ended up being.
Yeah, yeah. Which I am thankful for, because it is such a lovely format. It is such a lovely form for the stories to be told. Which, leads me to the question that using the encyclopedic form frees you up to maybe include more than if you had like a straight narrative,
mm-hmm.
Or even if it's prose poems, it would be a challenge to bring in so much of the scientific information, medical information. But I'm sure that, or I'm not sure, but I just had the inkling that there would be entries that you wanted to include and then decided not to include. And so I'm curious, how did you select the words you were going to use for the entries? And were there runners up that did not make it to Braille Encyclopedia?
Yes, there were so many runners up. There were sort of several rounds of runners up. So when I first thought, oh, I'm going to write this encyclopedia form, I did come up with big laundry lists of like words that I thought would be interesting to write about. And so the very first draft was the ones that I ended up having something to say about, which was by no means the full first list. And then in the revision process, in conversation with the, and then I did have various developmental edits and have people read various versions. Sometimes there's a piece that has a purpose, but it's just not that good. So some went by the wayside for those reasons. And then in the final version, so it's sort of once I got the edits from Rose Metal Press, then I ended up writing a whole bunch of new entries, kind of in response to things they felt were missing. They really helped make kind of a path through the book. There wasn't as much of a, like those kind of, I think now there are sort of these braided through lines. There's, you know, Braille's life story. There's kind of my medical journey. And I think they were more, some of those pieces were missing or episodic or, so we ended up like tossing out certain things that maybe worked. So I think as the manuscript I submitted had a lot more of a through line about my identity as a visual artist and how that changed, and sort of also hung a lot on that woman in blue, that Vermeer painting.
I love that piece. Yeah.
Yeah. That reappears. There was a lot of, the prose poem book leaned a lot more heavily on that image and what it meant to me and art making. And I don't think it was like a conscious decision to get rid of the art making, but as we kind of amplified or brought forward other themes in the book, that one sort of, a lot of those vanished. So there was a very kind of back and forth between like, oh, it'd be nice to have a piece about X or Y.
Mm-hmm.
Could I come up with one? And then there was also just the kind of mind puzzle of, oh, we need a letter X. What what can we do with X? So there was a lot of like, oh, let's go look at, and this is where the modern online world
is. It's for the readers to find out what your entries were.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And so then it becomes like, it became a real puzzle at the end to could keep things in the order, but also kind of match the form. So that was a puzzle at the end.
Yeah. I thought it flowed beautifully. And honestly, I thought it was the other way around. I'm surprised to hear that there was more about the art making. But I should have guessed, because you did mention in your interview that they were prose poems. So now it makes sense. But I had thought it was like a lot of information or definitions that you had bridged into, connected into meaning, you know, crossing the gap between the information definition to meaning. But now that I know, when I read your interview, it kind of made sense that that would have been the process as you described.
Yeah. And actually, so there was a phase where I did spend, you know, days of my life looking up etymologies and meanings and playing around with that. But I think I ultimately found that kind of limiting, both as, I mean, I love etymologies and language.
Yeah.
I found it somewhat limiting to only start from that jumping off point of what does a word mean? Mm-hmm. So there were places where I was looser about that.
I see.
Some of them did literally grow out of a response to reading a definition and playing with it. And sometimes that was grafted on after, or some, and you know, some entries just don't really fit that fictional form. So
this is really the difference between like the writing part of it and the revision part of it, which is a lot more strategic and pragmatic. Then it's a lot less romantic.
I feel that there's a creative piece. There's a very creative piece in that, like the constraint of, oh, I set up this fictional form, and how do I actually meet that form? That was hard. It was like, oh, we need this letter or that letter, but that became the creative assignment then.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's right. The challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, some pieces didn't make it into the eventual piece because ultimately I'd written one that I liked better or fit in a better place or answered a question that the editors had as, you know, people didn't live inside my head all the time.
That's right.
So helpful. Like, just to have that, going back to being kind of a process person, having a book published like I had many friends read the manuscript at different developmental stages. I hired writers who I love to do an edit or read or respond to it. But they're not publishing the thing. And it's really that there's something about someone who wants your book but doesn't know you, just saying, this is how this comes across, which I just found creatively incredibly, incredibly useful experience.
As a writer who is really serious about publishing, I think that's very useful to, you know, to kind of acknowledge that your work will be read by somebody who totally does not know you, who, you know, who will pick it up as the work itself and not with any other context around that.
Right. And so that's just an interesting experience.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, you know, speaking of writing, one entry I loved was the entry on the coastal cliff dwelling worm. And as you had compared it to being a writer, like the worm eats its way and then grows in size, and it can only go forward. It can't go back because it obviously cannot fit anymore in that previous hole. So you said that as writers, you know, we have to just keep gnawing, writing forward into the future. And that, you know, that entry really resonated with me. So do you mean to say that, you know, as the world changes, our lives change, and as we grow, do we also change the way we write, in essence?
I hope so. I think I hope that we change. I'll speak for myself that I try to be at peace with things that I wrote 10 or 20 years ago, and I have a different perspective, or I've learned something about that experience that I didn't know at the time I wrote that piece. And if it's out in the world and published, I try to just be, well, that's what I knew then, and I wouldn't write that now. So some of it is what we learn as human beings, as we hopefully learn as we go through life, that we gain in awareness. But also, yeah, I feel like I'm going to be one of those people who's, you know, if I'm able, learning new writing techniques when I'm, you know, 70 or 80 or 90. So I think, I don't know that my new writing is better. It's just that I am curious about different things, both in terms of what I want to write about, and also in like the challenge of what form I want to write in. So yeah. I think I mentioned before, like, oh, I loved writing a sonnet or a villanelle. And that doesn't interest me in the same way now, I'm sure. I learned, and it is like the coastal worm image, that's still in me. It's still something I bring to my prose. But yeah, that container isn't big enough for what I want to write.
So how has writing changed for you? I mean, you said in the book, you know, the Velcro of memory has lost its grip, glutted with lint, and my fingertips remembers more braille than my hippocampus. So, you know, the brain can't hold so much anymore, but muscle memory, it's a different kind of memory now, right? So how does the writing process transform in the face of that?
That's a great question. I mean, I think one thing is to understand that actually probably our memories never worked that well. Like, I used to remember more stuff, but, you know, to kind of go back to the neuroscience stuff, memory is a story we make up.
It's another story.
But we remember specific things to survive, right?
Yes, yes.
And so we're all fiction writers, right? Even when my memory was young and athletic and all of those things, I still remember different things than my brother or my sisters. I see it in my own family now that people remember different things, or they insert themselves in a story that everyone else was like, you weren't there. Like, so So memory's always been fallible. I think as we age, it's like we just come to understand that. But I think the thing that opens up then potentially is the imagination and the combination of what my rotting memory comes up with. And I think the challenge there is that then if I'm writing something I'm calling nonfiction, how do I not do injustice to the facts?
Yeah, right. Like what kind of, which truth, if that is the right question, or like, how do you stay true to the intention? Is that the right question to ask?
How do you, and also, I guess one of, again, is just sort of a practical answer, which is when it's important, I try to go do some research to bolster my memory, right? So, and that happened a lot in the encyclopedia, the Braille encyclopedia, because, you know, I just didn't remember a lot about, I remembered some things about when I was 13, but that's a long time ago, you know? So, and then the nature of my ongoing vision loss is like, if I remembered every software command that I'd ever known to do every possible task or every frustrating non-accessible experience I had in grad school, like it would just be annoying. Like it would be annoying and frustrating to me. And I think it would be annoying to a reader to just read how frustrated I was, right?
So yeah.
Not that it was unimportant, but it doesn't make for good reading. So I don't know, is that answering your question about
yes,
memory?
It does. And like maybe like what becomes important in the writing process for you is different from what it used to be, right?
I think it's both end. It's like, oh, there are other ways to get information besides what I remember.
Yeah.
I'm more and more interested in that space of imagination. Mm-hmm. Like in terms of like, there's some pieces in the book about grandparents or ancestors, and
right.
I have very little information about any of them. And just, I think there's something to be said for just sort of sitting with like, what do I imagine for this person? Mm-hmm. As long as we claim it clearly as like, I don't know, I'm making this up. I think that's still a...
Yeah. You also illustrated it really well in your book when you talked about facts and... Mm-hmm. You know, as a copy editor, so here we're gonna mention it. One of the professional work that you did that I really envied was that you were a copy editor for the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I didn't even know you could be a copy editor. But that makes sense, right? They do need copy editors.
Mm-hmm.
But you had talked about you need to cite. For it to be a fact, it needs to be cited in 3 reputable publications.
Mm-hmm.
But even that is not, you know, infallible.
Correct, yes.
Such as the fact about the death of Bruce Chatwin. He had died of AIDS, but you actually found 3 reputable sources saying that it was like, what was it? Fungal infection or something?
Yes, he died of a rare fungal disease.
I see.
And of course, this was the 80s. So the word AIDS was,
So it was a euphemism.
Well, I think, I don't know. But yes, I think there was just so much fear and bigotry around AIDS and HIV. And not that there is none now, but the world has really changed. So I didn't delve into that piece, but the environment was so different. But
right.
But also, I think the part of why the piece is in there for me is also... I do have a bias that like we don't treat facts very well now, but even when we like, and I don't know that Britannica does still hire fact checkers, but you know,
wow, back in the 80s, would be sad.
I mean, I hope they do, but back in the 80s, like there were you know, 30 or 40 people who worked in the copy editing department. And they fact-checked things and they made sure that the Oxford comma was there or not there. And, you know, so it wasn't actually very fun work and possibly kind of personality distorting to spend all day looking for typos. But but there was a real commitment to getting things straight, at least as far as those facts. I mean, I might be digressing, but it's also like, well, but what is, what gets put in the encyclopedia? It's all, that's also a fiction, right? That because there's nothing but fact-checked facts in a piece, that that is the whole truth about something.
Yes.
Right. Or that, or who gets to be included in the encyclopedia. Like, those are also important things. Anyway.
I like it. I know, but I like better. I feel like it's connected to how you conceptualize the Braille encyclopedia. It's a, it's not exactly an encyclopedia. It's a reimagining because each entry is connected. It tells like a complete story, and it highlights actually how disconnected entries are in encyclopedias, or how random. Like as you said, who selects what gets in there? Why does the coastal worm get in there?
Right.
And not other worms, for example.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, that makes, that's, all of that really makes the book, which I highly recommend, really interesting. But another thing that I really, you know, wanted to talk about before we wrap this up is the concept of, you know, the different, you talk about the legal line between vision and blindness. And you said that, you know, your altered sight kind of made you a citizen of one country instead of another. And contrasting that with, you know, the invention of Braille, the first iteration actually only made sense to blind people. And he had to create another system that also made sense to sighted people. So it's like there's this kind of impression that, yes, you kind of lose the sighted world, but there's also a discovery of this different world. And, you know, how did you, how do you feel about that? And how do you tackle that also in the book?
Yeah, I love the way you framed that. Like, part of the book is definitely about a sense of loss, that I don't see the world in the way that I used to, and that things I used to love to do have been impacted by that. But you totally nailed the sense of like, oh, but this other universe opens up. And I guess I have a little... You were talking about Braille. So he invented Braille as a system of writing and reading for blind folk that, a sighted person could learn that tactile writing system. But the bias at that time and for many years after was that whatever blind folks do should be accessible. They should learn what sighted people do. So there was definitely a huge, to me, bias in that.
Yeah.
But then... I just love that the system you're talking about, I'm not sure even how to say it, but it's called Raffigraphy, and he created a system that would both create a tactile impression that a blind person could read, but also had little inked dots that would form letters that sighted people could read. So I just love that I love that he was so brilliant. He was clearly just a total
definitely
genius.
Yeah.
but that bridging those two different universes was so important to him.
And that speaks to like the advances in technology and science now, right? Like for blind people and disabled people in general. But I think that, you know, there's still a long way to go. I think partly because these technologies are developed by sighted people mostly. and they consult. Of course, they consult and they test, but you know. So I'm curious. You know, what do you think are the most important things to explore or learn for you, in the realm of literacy, especially when it comes to technology for blind and disabled folks?
Well, so I'm going to speak out of both sides of my mouth here, because I both feel that I have so much more access to the world and to reading and writing through basically mainstream technology than I did even 10 years ago. I used to have lots and lots of dedicated, very expensive, blind-specific kinds of technology. And now with my phone, I can take a picture of something. It will often offer a description of, like, I can just take a picture of some text that I can't read, and I'll get maybe a 95% accurate transcription of that. It will read it to me as text. And that's all in a, like, there's settings on a phone that maybe you, I'm assuming you're sighted, a sighted person wouldn't use, but they're just in there under the general settings, like whether your Wi-Fi's on or off. So that's amazing. And also so much reading in accessible format is available to me on my phone, both specifically for blind folk, but also, like, if I buy a Kindle book, I can have my laptop or my phone read it to convert that visual text into speech. So there's already so much. I'm only going to be self-contradicting once, but I'll be say three contradictory things. So the thing I like that really most grills my cheese out in the world is actually that people, like, if people wouldn't leave scooters in the middle of the pavement, that would make my day. Like, that is more of a threatening thing to me.
Yes.
And I have some ambient vision, and I have, you know, friends who use wheelchairs where, you know, if somebody doesn't shovel the snow up here in Minnesota, they are literally trapped and can't get to the pharmacy. So anyway, I think that actually human interaction and behavior is the thing that on a daily basis most, you know,
it's like the most basic things are actually
the biggest.
The biggest. Yeah, that's a really great point. Yeah.
So I don't really care. Like, and actually probably AI is built in, you know, or machine learning, maybe not chat, you know, is built into so much of the technology that blind folks use. So I have to be grateful for that. Even as a person who's, you know, quote, a content creator, I'm appalled by the massive theft of people's content to go into training AI. But so then the third or fourth thing, I've lost the plot on how many things I've said, is that I understand that not everybody wants to learn Braille, and I'm far from, I think one of the wonderful things about being blind now is there's a bunch of different ways to do almost anything. And I strongly believe that people should choose what works for them based on what they're interested in. Like, I don't care about driving that much. It's a pain not to be able to drive around, but that's not one of my dreams. But when I was in vocational rehab, like the, 19-year-old young men who were blind were like, that's what they missed, was like, they wanted to drive and they wanted a rite of passage. Right. And so, you know, different people have different needs. But having said, like, hey, everyone should, you know, choose their own path, I do think that Braille has a real impact on literacy.
Yeah. So
that to me, the way, if I had learned, I wasn't born blind, so I read print and then transitioned to these other ways of reading. And Braille is the only thing that has cognitively and emotionally approximated that experience of actually being literate in print. And I think for somebody who cares about language, learning Braille is really empowering in a way that that my text to speech is not for me.
Yeah.
So, and somebody
especially as a writer.
Yeah.
Right?
And, you know, someone else will just say, well, that's because you're not a very good, you don't use your screen reader very efficiently. Or, you know, like, again, I do hope that there continues to be access to Braille learning.
Yeah.
Encouragement for Braille learning, because it's not particularly easy, but it's incredibly useful in terms of a depth of connection to language, written language.
I was going to say, it's also the, you know, in writing, it's also the act of writing that feels that you feel connected to the process, right? And I imagine, because I do not have experience with it, I imagine that learning and expressing yourself using Braille kind of connects that for you, or, you know.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, I feel like the whole book is about, maybe not about this, but the reason I put all the energy I did into learning Braille at a time when it really wasn't that practical in my life was the idea of having a way of keeping a hand written or made journal. So using a slate and stylus, like that hinged.
I was so fascinated by that. Yeah.
So this hinged piece of metal that you clamp onto a piece of paper and it has little openings, and with a little stylus you poke in these little holes or little bumps, and that was not easy, but also there was something really important to me about reclaiming, like, I can have a journal that I can read, it's not on my computer,
you can make
matter. If it doesn't matter if Word Perfect no longer exists, you know.
Yeah, it blew my mind how intricate the process was. Like, and you said that it's at that point that people leave the room and says, nope, I don't want to learn it anymore. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And you know, there's all sorts of ways to use Braille without learning slate and stylus.
Of course. Right.
That's just that, I think, that connection between, like, well, what matters to me? Like, someone else is going to put their life energy into some other thing, right?
Yeah.
But that's my thing.
Yeah. And, you know, we could keep talking about this book forever, I think. Not really forever, but, you know, but I think we should, you know, I'm going to wrap this up by you know, asking you the talking writing question, which we ask every author, which is, like, you know, why do we write? You know, what is the use of writing that keeps us doing it, even when, you know, usefulness in the practical sense of the word, which is monetary, I guess, you know, and you had mentioned that earlier, it's not that useful, but it's useful in other ways. So I wanted to know your take on it.
I do. I love that question. And, as a teacher of writing, I work largely with older adults and other people with disabilities. And I ran this poetry group for years at this one location. And the way we talked about it was, like, what is worth getting out of bed for? Like, I don't expect everybody in the building that I worked in to care about poetry. But for those, you know, half dozen or 8 or 10 people that was the thing they got out of bed for. So that's one thing I think writing is for, is, like, just if it motivates us to get on with our day in the face of whatever else is going on. I think there's a real usefulness to uselessness, like things that don't, I feel that if we all spent time on things that we loved that had no practical use, the world might actually be a better place. Like, that if we were all had the ability to spend more time, if writing's our thing, writing. I don't know, like, maybe there's a use, maybe that's a form of witness. Maybe that's what it's about for me in some way.
I was busy note-taking, so I was what is worth getting out of bed for? There's a real usefulness to uselessness.
Yeah.
Yes.
I feel that, like, art and writing in the last, 5 or 10 years, we ask a lot more the question of, like, that writing changes in the world. And mm-hmm. I think because I did earn my living as a writer in terms of writing communications for nonprofits and doing grant writing and raising money. And so for me personally, I really value writing that isn't persuading anybody, right. isn't telling somebody, oh, there's this problem you need to fix and just give us money. And I'm not dissing that, you know, as a, I think there are ethical ways to do that, and bringing attention to issues that we need to know about is important. But I just really revel in, I'm just writing this, and I like the way these words sound together, or I'm really obsessed with this one image. And so it keeps me off the streets, you know.
It feels like, you know, as you said, the usefulness of uselessness, it's tied to how just unmeasurable or uncategorizable being human is, or, you know, how human life is important, but you can't quite measure it.
Like, right. It's,
you know,
it's, that's a lovely way. It isn't, it can't be put on a spreadsheet. It can't be measured in that way. And yeah, I mean, people have been making art for, you know, tens of thousands of years.
Forever, like, it's
some basic, basic human impulse. And and writing, I view writing as just one arm of that. So.
Right, right. Wow, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on that. I really enjoyed it. And thank you, Naomi, for joining us today. And have a good rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.